The heavy snow that shut down traffic over Snoqualmie Pass and Stevens Pass a few weeks ago inspired a former member of Congress from Seattle to reach out to Governor Jay Inslee with a bold solution for avoiding similar problems in the future. The solution is over 100 years old, and so that, of course, got our resident historian Felix Spinell all excited to go deep on the story. The older the story is, the more he likes it. Felix is brought to you by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. You're not talking about a tunnel, are you?
I'm talking about when dinosaurs roamed the earth.
No, I'm not. Okay.
The story is a little convoluted in some respects and pretty simple in others. So I spoke with former Representative Jim McDermott a few days ago. You know, he retired from Congress 5 years ago after representing the 7th District for 14 terms. He first came to Seattle from Chicago in 1966. To get here, he drove with his wife and their six-week-old baby, and they came over Snoqualmie Pass for the very first time in a two-door hardtop Corvair pulling a U-Haul trailer.
Wow.
Now, so during the big snow and the closure of the passes a few weeks ago and those shortages in the grocery stores, McDermott, who's 85 now and living part of the year in France but reading the paper online and watching CNN, well, he sent an email to Governor Inslee reviving an idea for a major piece of infrastructure. Maybe you can see where I'm going here. Now, this wasn't originally Jim McDermott's idea. It came from a now-deceased legislator from Tacoma named Slim Rasmussen. And the nickname Slim was ironic, apparently. Yeah. Now, this goes back 42 years to when Jim McDermott was looking for campaign ideas to connect with Eastern Washington voters, because he was a liberal from Seattle running for governor against Republican John Spellman.
And I thought, well, you know, that reminds me of my campaign in 1980. I asked Slim Rasmussen, I said, you know, I'm a guy from Seattle. What can I do that might attract attention from Eastern Washington? And he was an old locomotive engineer. His name was Slim Rasmussen. And he had worked on the railroad. And Slim said to me, Jim, if you want to help the people in Eastern Washington, what they need is a sea level tunnel under the Cascades. And he said, there's one planned here a long time ago, many years ago. I never saw the plans or anything. He just told me that. And so I thought, well, I proposed that if I became governor, I'd push through a ground level, you know, so we could have an all-weather transportation between Seattle and Eastern Washington.
Wow.
Seems like a great idea. We love tunnels around here.
Yeah.
Now, the idea, it wasn't exactly a sea level tunnel. It was more of a below the snow level tunnel for cars and trains. It was something Slim Rasmussen had read an old report about. Jim McDermott can't remember if he made this an official part of his 1980 platform, but he says he did talk about it on the campaign trail. So I got in touch with a great friend of the show, Benjamin Helley at the Washington Archives, and he found an incredible 100-page report from 1936. It's just packed with amazing facts and bizarre twists of about 30 years of history of plans for Cascade Tunnels. Now, the original idea for a Cascade Tunnel, anywhere from 29 miles to 68 miles long,
wow,
which sounds crazy, goes back to 1907, and Hiram M. Chittenden, the Army Corps of Engineers genius who built the government locks connecting Puget Sound to Lake Washington back in 1916, and who was something of a complicated figure in local history. Now, there were other studies in the 20s, and this 1936 study is actually pretty discouraging about the tunnel's prospects and feasibility. You know, they quote Chittenden's estimates, and they say he probably lowballed it. The 1936 cost for a 30-mile tunnel was somewhere from $62 million to $100 million. And I think that's about $3 billion in 2022 dollars.
Yeah.
You know, build back better. They worried that seeking federal funding for a tunnel back then, this is the middle of the Depression, right, would threaten other federal projects that were underway, like the Grand Coulee Dam or those big reclamation irrigation projects in the Big Bend area of the Columbia River Basin. And they also said that one of the attractions of driving for recreational purposes was the view, and that goes away, of course, with a long tunnel. And they didn't actually settle on a single route. It could have been Snoqualmie Pass or Stevens Pass or even Natchez Pass, and that it varied from, I think, 29 to 68 miles. Now, one thing they also said which changed was that snow removal in 1909 was pretty crude, or 1907, but that's the state had gotten much better at it by equipping two-man snowplow crews with two-way radios and directing traffic and having them move to where the problems were. So Chittenden, in his report, says the passes would be closed for months at a time back then. But in 1909, the passes were like dirt roads, pretty rudimentary and rough. And this report says that by the winter of 1930-1931, state crews were able to keep Snoqualmie Pass open year-round for the first time. And that seems pretty recent to me. So this tunnel, you know, is it a thing? I guess the first indicator is the response that Jim McDermott got from Governor Inslee, and this is a Cairo News Radio exclusive.
And when I talked to Jay, the thing you don't know is he responded to me. And he said, Jim, it's a great idea. He said, but I got to tell you something. I've been talking to Peter DeFazio, and it looks like whatever money you get is going to go into a high-speed rail between Portland and Vancouver. And he said, you were always 40 years ahead of the curve. And I laughed and said, well, you know, what the hell? So this one is an idea that if you think long term, if you think the weather's going to get better around here, I mean, Leavenworth is buried in snow, right? That's what's happening here. And it, from an environmental standpoint, it makes good sense to do it.
You know, and to be clear, Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon's chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. So that was Inslee talking about federal money. You know, with Sully's help, I checked with WSDOT, I checked with the governor's office and got essentially the same polite response. You know, it's not something currently under consideration, and please stop wasting our time, you little history weirdo. I made up that last part. Now, on the surface, you know, no pun intended, a 50-mile-long tunnel seems like a pretty wacky idea. But a couple things have changed since 1936 that might be significant. The first is about, is they're both related to climate change. And the first is whether or not big snowy shutdowns of the passes are going to become more common. And the second is, does a long tunnel with electric trains and cars mean a smaller carbon footprint than how we currently move people and freight over the Cascades, you know, using gas and diesel-powered cars and trains? At one point in my conversation with Jim McDermott, he mentioned longtime Democratic former senator from Washington, Warren G. Magnuson, and how Magnuson was a big believer in the premise that if you don't care about who gets the credit, you can get a lot done.
Right.
But I still had to ask Jim McDermott a pretty important question about getting credit.
Now, I know you don't want to get credit for it, but should this tunnel come to pass many decades from now, would you smile down from heaven if it was named the McDermott Tunnel?
Yes. But you know how life is, man. When you die twice. You die once when you pass. And you die a second time when they stop telling stories about you.
Yeah, so you mentioned that, you know, we were talking about Slim Rasmussen. He wants to be talked about the way Slim Rasmussen is being talked about now. So one thing, it does remind me of earlier transportation projects that were just too big and maybe too wacky. You know, we talked here before about the idea of connecting Olympia to Grays Harbor with a ship canal. There were plans to build bridges across Puget Sound via Bainbridge Island. And I guess those things only seem wacky because they never happened. You know, same seems true for a super long Cascade Tunnel. We do have some pretty long tunnels in the Cascades. There's like the one that goes through Stevens Pass, I think is 8 miles long. The trains go through, and that, you know, avoids deadly avalanches and things like that. You know, and in talking to McDermott, there's one more thing I want to mention here that, you know, I grew up in kind of an odd family that might explain a lot about my radio career. You know, my dad was a conservative Republican, kind of like Dan Evans. Mostly because he hated his World War II nemesis and one-time captors, the Soviet Union, and he thought Republicans were tougher on commies. But my mom, on the other hand, was a liberal Democrat and super active in party politics in the 70s and 80s.
My mom was a volunteer in your 1980 campaign, and she had a Jim McDermott sticker on her Pinto.
Well, what goes around comes around, man.
So,
I covered that campaign, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you did.
There the night that he conceded at the old Eagles Auditorium downtown. And
He beat Dixie Lee Ray in the primary, which was a big deal. He primaried the governor and won. But he was defeated by John Spellman.
John Spellman, yeah.
And yeah, so yeah, with my family, it's like I was raised by Tom and Curly, my mom and dad. So they canceled out each other's vote every year. So.
Lucky
anyway,
you.
I don't think this tunnel is going to come to fruition anytime soon, but I love these big ideas. They get you thinking about the possibilities.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been through the tunnel right under the English Channel. That's 31 miles
too.
And survived that, so I suppose you could survive this. But, man, would that be expensive, Felix?
I drove some long tunnel in Iceland that goes under a fjord. It's like 8, 9, 10 miles long, and it's just I was paranoid and like breathing badly the whole time. It was terrifying.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MindNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Suppose we find out what the Washington State Legislature is up to. On the agenda, more bills on police reform, and there is a new measure to give lawmakers more control during states of emergency. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. First, I'm going to start off with an update on one we talked about yesterday. You remember yesterday I told you that the Democrats had a plan to get the long-term care tax delay done here over the next couple of weeks and over onto the governor's desk. It will likely still happen, but there's going to be some fireworks on the House floor today, which is where we expect the delay bill to come up for a vote, not before Republicans make some noise, though. This is Peter Abarno, Republican representative, who had a bill that didn't get a hearing, and he's concerned about the delay of this tax.
Which is why I introduced House Bill 1594. Which would repeal the Washington CARES Act and eliminate the payroll tax. The objective findings of the Office of Actuary evidence is that the program has fatal flaws at really all three phases, from the regressive tax collection, which over 450,000 workers have already opted out, to the restrictive investment strategy, which is treasuries, to the limited short-term benefit. And you don't have to get past probably further than the actuarial report, probably about page three, where the fund is insolvent.
Now, I will point out the Democrats has previously said they don't believe, based on that actuary report, that the plan is insolvent. So unclear to me which one is right. Republican Representative Drew Stokesbury, though, agrees that it is insolvent. He, too, wants to see the plan repealed and has his own bill.
I think we need to revisit this concept and this program entirely and what we're doing in the legislature. I think you'll hear the majority try to explain how good it is to have people with long-term care coverage. But as Peter pointed out, nobody's disputing that. I think there's broad bipartisan agreement that having some solution is good. The question is, what should that solution be? And I'm afraid that without giving these bills a hearing, the legislature is locking ourselves into only one particular solution that isn't really a solution at all.
Now, he had not just a repeal, but a replace bill.
So instead, I introduced 1913, which would leverage the state's significant $8.8 billion surplus to stabilize the private market and allow for private insurance carriers to ultimately offer much lower premiums to subscribers like you and me that were previously shut out of the market. It does this through a system of reinsurance that insurers would then get a tax credit for, refunded by the state. So we essentially would be leveraging the state's largesse to absorb the riskiest portion of this market, which is why coverage in the private market has been so unaffordable and unattainable before.
So they are upset because neither of those bills got any discussion or hearing, and they really feel that it needs to be done. So today, before the Democrats bring up the bills for a delay for a vote, House Minority Leader J.T. Wilcox says,
have not been given hearings. We've asked for hearings repeatedly. And so we will be offering parliamentary motions before the Democratic bills are voted on for consideration of these important bills. And I think, honestly, there's plenty of people on the other side that would like to support them.
So I didn't have a chance to poll everybody on both sides of the aisle to see how that might go, but it will definitely cause a few fireworks, I think, when we see the House go on the floor today. The other surprise that came yesterday was a new bill. We talked a lot about the governor's emergency powers. There's a few bills out there from Republicans. I think one of them has one Democratic co-sponsor. But this is Senator Emily Randall. She is one of the leading Democrats in the Senate, and she yesterday dropped a bill to try to give the lawmakers more power when it comes to states of emergency.
When we get significant federal funds that instead of only the governor having a say, that we ensure that the legislature has a say in the process of spending those unanticipated receipts. The other thing it does is allows for a four corners decision of the legislature, and that's, you know, the leadership of the House and the leadership of the Senate of both parties to unanimously, after 90 days, end emergency orders.
So that would be 90 days into the state of emergency. If there's a feeling that there is no longer an emergency, they can, if all four of them agree, they can end it. They can put an end to it, so it wouldn't be.
So should we be surprised that there are even some Democrats who think the governor apparently has too much power?
I think for sure it depends on how close of attention you pay to the legislature. So last session, the Democratic leadership was asked at the beginning, do you think that we need to, you know, put some sort of curbing on the governor's emergency powers? And they were adamantly no. Absolutely not. There's been various lawsuits. It's been upheld. We think he's doing great. And it's not that they say that he's, you know, not doing great now. It's just it's 2 years in. And the yeah. sense at this point is that really when those laws were written that are on the books right now, nobody really expected it to be a 2 year emergency. Right. It wasn't right. made for.
Is
a
there
pandemic.
Any particular thing that I mean, I know Republicans have come out against the many of the governor's mandates. Are there any mandates that Democrats are dissatisfied with?
There's you're hard pressed to get any kind of a specific description. You get a lot of my constituents say that kind of thing. Actually, Randall did explain one issue, though.
So this is really about putting a check on an emergency that, you know, people may feel have gone on too long. You know, they're my co-sponsor, Senator Vandeweghe, represents, you know, the 24th on the Olympic Peninsula, where for a time they had little to no COVID infection, but we're still under the same emergency orders as the rest of the state. So this ensures that there is a place for legislators to have a stronger voice.
And because so many, and even on all sides, you heard that from some Democrats, yeah. and that situation she's talking about there was when there was the lockdown, right? The whole state,
right.
and we started doing like certain
things.
Well, it's
that one-size-fits-all approach, which
right,
may
exactly.
not be appropriate in some cases.
Yeah. Exactly. And a lot, she said she heard from Republicans and Democrats that they were hearing from people on all sides, and independents, who were saying, we think that we're not getting as much representation as we should in this so long into this, and it's affecting, you know, our livelihoods, our all of that. So this would put a check in place to give everyone more of a voice, really. We'll see what happens. She said she expects it to get a hearing, I believe, in the state government Senate committee sometime soon. So we'll see how that goes. So no, she didn't know how her colleagues had felt about it so much yet. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Quickly, I want to get into the law enforcement bill. There's been a lot of discussion about one of the police reform bills that was passed last session. A lot of questions about the police pursuits. James McMahon with WASPIC, Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, explained yesterday what the issue is.
Simply put, if the pursuit is more dangerous than the offense, we cannot pursue. Current law requires both probable cause, except for DUI, and an imminent threat. House Bill 1788, had it been enacted last year, would have enabled officers to respond appropriately when, for example, a wrong way hit and run driver on Interstate 5, a stolen school bus from Leavenworth, the individual who went on later the next day to use a front loader to flip a vehicle onto his own garage in an effort to murder his wife.
So, and he had a list of examples of when there was pursuits that couldn't be done for yeah. people who got away. And this bill does away with that. It takes away that probable cause aspect, also that imminent threat aspect, and it allows them to pursue. But there was, you know, so you heard from law enforcement who was at this committee yesterday saying this will increase public safety. This will allow us to do our jobs again.
Okay, but so then, listening to the cops this year.
Well, they are in part, but you had just as many community members who were big pushers for the reforms last year who came out and said, you're making a mockery of everything we did last year. This just puts it back to the status quo. And the problem with that was there were people, especially with pursuits, who felt people of color were disproportionately affected in pursuits and shot and killed in mm-hmm. pursuits. So that's where we are. We'll see. There was going to be some tweaks to it. There was also a bill dropped yesterday. I haven't had a chance to look at it, but it defines physical force, which has been the big key sticking point in all of these bills about force, is that you don't know exactly what physical force is. So I'll be looking into that definition and get back to you on that bill.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
And your daily dose of kindness today brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A kind-hearted plumber is being hailed a hero for the work he does for free. He specifically helps elderly and disabled, and he was inspired to wind down his private plumbing business into more of a nonprofit after seeing a disabled man being taken advantage of by another company.
When we rectified the issue for the gentleman who was elderly and disabled, it played on my mind for days afterwards, and then I made the decision to create a company that can be used for the community and help the elderly and the disabled and the vulnerable in the community. And that's how DEFA came about, maybe because of that one incident.
James Anderson thinks he's helped thousands of elderly and vulnerable adults since he began his efforts and recently went viral when one of his bills was posted online. It said across the receipt, "No charge for this lady under any circumstances. We will be available 24 hours to help her and keep her as comfortable as possible." He fundraises and has a GoFundMe page open to raise funds to cover the costs, and his services are free as often as possible.
We'll charge the least we could possibly count to cover the costs of getting the materials and getting to them. But mainly, it's free. As long as we've got funding, they won't pay a penny.
And because of that, he often goes into debt and says people ask him why he would go into debt to do this. Well, his answer, he says he'd rather himself owe some money to somebody than another person be alive, happy, and safe because of it. Of course, an answer like that inspired donations. They began flooding in. They've hit tens of thousands of dollars or pounds since he's in England. He says he feels overwhelmed, and all of this has made him realize how kind people are. He adds he doesn't feel like he's doing anything particularly kind, just what feels right.
Yep, makes sense. I know people who are living alone, and if a little thing goes wrong, right, like the toilet backs up or the thermostat goes out, where do you turn?
And how do you know who to trust? You know, you got to put bids out and all of that. So, yeah, he's doing a great service.
7:48, and now from the G and Ursula Show, here is G Scott, who is a radio host, auctioneer, and now podcaster with a new show called Leaving a Legacy. And who's your guest this week, G?
Dan Price. He is the Gravity CEO that has made world news by the guaranteed minimum of $70,000 a year for each of his employees.
Gravity payments, and they basically credit card processing, right?
Yep.
And well, let's have a little excerpt from him. I mean, I think most people in Seattle are familiar with what he did, and he continues to do it. Some people thought it'd be a flash in the pan, but he's stuck with it.
I got to tell you what, G, a big part of it too is there's so much propaganda out there to help billionaires and wealthy people, and we all go around spreading it. We do free PR, free propaganda for rich people every day. You know, I see it on Twitter and on LinkedIn when I post about these things. Everyone wants to stick up for the billionaires, and it really doesn't make sense. Of course, we all would like to see ourselves in that position someday because we believe in ourselves and we believe in the American dream and meritocracy. But the reality is the statistics say exactly the opposite, which is if you're not wealthy, chances are you're never going to be wealthy.
This has puzzled me for a long time, G, that people, for example, on this issue of this graduated state income tax, the people who would be helped most by it seem to hate it the most. Why is that?
I don't know, Dave. And I know that's not a good thing to say on the radio. And I don't know. But I want to take a shot at it, if you will. I think that it is just what we have learned. It's how we have learned. It's what we have seen on TV. And I think it is the promise of the American dream. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of us that have in our minds, and at least I used to have in my mind, that if I work really, really hard, I too someday can become a billionaire. And I think that's the part where there's a lot of folks that fight. Like, for an example, I have friends that are really rich that'll text me and be like, "Gee, I heard you on the radio today, man. You crazy, man." I said, but I asked, and they hear me always fighting for people that make low wages, always fighting for people with low income. And me saying how much the billionaires and the millionaire, they need to pay a higher tax rate than someone that is low income. And so they say, they laugh with me, because they know, but I never have an argument with someone that's really rich. I only argue with folks that aren't. And that is the weirdest thing to me.
That always struck me, like when you go into like a sandwich shop, for instance, like we'll say it's a nice franchise sandwich shop and you ask for extra toppings and they're like, "We're only allowed to give you one serving of this topping." And I want to go like, who are you protecting?
your billionaire corporation, or can you just give me some more olives, right? Like, no. We also, as workers, become protective of our corporation in the face of another human being. And that's really small potatoes, the olives thing and toppings. But it goes to this whole people who aren't wealthy protecting the billionaires, making excuses for them why their earned money is theirs to keep and not theirs to spread around and spread the wealth.
But it's genius. Like, what I mean genius, if you, as I always say in my house, not on the radio, but when you rack them and stack them, when it comes down to it, the top 1% in our country own 40% of the land in this country. The top 10% in our country have 75% of the money.
Is that what he, is that part of the podcast? Is he roll out those statistics?
And he didn't roll. No, he didn't. No, he didn't roll out that one. This is me rolling these things out, because this has been my hobby lately. Like this right here, this whole the understanding the economy, understanding all the barriers that have been put in place, understanding visually what happened. So for an example, if you just take a second and you go back to the old times, whether it's in Europe in the 1400s, 1500s, and you have all of these people all wanting and begging for bread, and please let me have bread and water, please, and bread. And then you have a few people that's on the mountaintop and they're looking down at everyone and they're just kind of throwing bread and throwing a little bread, and you're just so happy for the bread. Imagine being in that crowd and fighting with people in that car. And by the way, it doesn't matter what color you are, black, mm-hmm. white, purple, it don't matter.
You're all poor. Yeah.
You're in the crowd, and one person says, hey, you better not say anything about the king up there. I'm like, man, I ain't trying to say nothing. I'm just trying to get some extra bread. You don't need any extra bread. You just need a little bit of bread.
This is why we have to stop worshiping the dollar, right? Like, I've been going through that transformation over the last half year, which is trying to find joy and happiness in something other than my productivity and success. Because that was my life from as far back as I can remember, is my self-worth was tied up in how productive and successful I was at my job, i.e. the money I earn. And I've had to reverse that because it led to absolute crash and burnout, because your job will never love you back. But you know who will? Your family, your friends, your hobbies, right?
You are preaching right there. And I'll end with this. I think for me, as someone who has been able to turn their life around over the last 10 years and where I've come to. And see, you see what I just did? You see how I said I, and that's actually not the truth, because the truth is I was only a small part of it. It was others that helped me. I'm where I am today because others said, let me help you. So today I'm going to use my platform. I'm going to use the little bit of money I have, and I'm going to help others. Everybody else, you can choose what you want to do, but this is what I want to do, because it is my way of saying and knowing I would not be where I am today without the help of others.
And by the way, back to your story, we all know what happened when the people down in the valley got tired of what was happening on the top of the mountain, right? They took out the pitchforks and they charged.
There you go.
7:54, G and Ursula coming up at 9 on Cairo Radio. So yesterday, I was stretching out for a relaxing afternoon, watching the Senate on C-SPAN. But this time, instead of nodding off, I perked right up because I heard that somebody out there apparently tried to impersonate Senator Maria Cantwell in the last election. This came as a complete surprise during last night's Senate debate over the voting rights bill. I heard a lot of stuff I'd heard before. I heard Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican of Alaska, scold Democrats for pushing a bill that requires, among other things, letting voters register on the day of the election, which he pointed out is something that a number of Democratic states don't even have.
I want my colleagues to come and answer this simple question. Why should we listen to you? Why should any American take you seriously when so many of you come from states with the most restrictive voting laws in America?
Well, of course, once he threw down that challenge, I had to stay tuned to see if anybody would take him up on it. And about 25 minutes later, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois stepped up and admitted that the senator from Alaska was correct. Even Illinois does not allow same-day voter registration.
I've heard my Republican colleagues make the argument, we'll take a look at the blue belt of America. States like Delaware and New York, they don't go as far as the law that's being suggested by you Democrats. The state of New York doesn't have it. The state of Delaware doesn't have it. In fact, the state of Illinois doesn't have it either. Well, my message to them is, good, let them get it. Those who are lagging, whether they're red or blue, should come into the 21st century.
So he says the blue states should be prepared to take their own medicine. But of course, the reason that red states are passing more restrictive voting laws is the concern about voter fraud, at least so they say. And Democrats argue that voter fraud is basically negligible, which is why it surprised me when right after Senator Durbin, here comes Senator Maria Cantwell of Edmonds, Washington, admitting that, yes, there are people who do try to pull off vote fraud. And in fact, she herself was a victim in the 2020 election.
I'm going to shock some people, I'm sure, by saying this. But when I went to vote in the last election, somebody had requested several ballots in my name. Several ballots in my name. I'm sure it was ill intent. There was nothing good about it. And when I looked to see that they hadn't counted my ballot, even though I had voted very early in the process, I became alarmed and I called the auditor and said, why haven't you counted my ballot? And he said, several people have filed ballots under your name. I'm sure ill intent and monkey business by somebody. So I decided I'm going down to the courthouse to see what this was all about. But by the time I got there, the auditor had sorted it out and said, I found the one signature that matches your signature, and we've counted your ballot.
I hadn't heard that story before, that Senator Cantwell herself was a victim of vote fraud. But her point here was that Washington's system of mail-in ballots and barcodes and same-day registration, et cetera, it works. Even when bad people deliberately try to commit fraud. And in her case, the problem was fixed and the real vote was counted. So the system works. But my question now is, did anyone ever go after who did this? As she herself pointed out, when you sign the registration form, you are attesting that everything on that form is truthful.
Knowingly providing false information about yourself or the qualifications for voter registration is a Class C felony, punishable by imprisonment or a fine up to $10,000 or both.
So I have emailed her office to ask if anybody tried to find the culprit here, because you have to provide validated to register, so they should easily be able to find out whoever lied when they registered. So we'll wait and see what happens. Let's talk about the juvenile justice system. Should children be put in jail? Some people would say no, never. And there, in fact, is a push to pause a King County diversion program for kids who are accused of their first felony because people think it's a little bit too lax. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott to explain this issue. Hannah.
Yes, good morning, Dave. So this the pause on this program, which is the Restorative Justice Community Pathways Program, was requested in the form of a proposed legislation yesterday by King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn.
What this new law would do is it would request that the King County prosecutor pause the very controversial Restorative Justice Community Pathways Program and force the prosecutor to work with local jurisdictions like Auburn, Federal Way, Kent, Renton, and others to discuss their very real concerns about the program. And while it's paused, I'm pitching that the prosecutor, through this law, remove some of the very serious felony charges from this juvenile and adult diversion program.
Later the prosecutor's office clarified that this is not this particular program does not apply to adults. We're just talking about juveniles here.
But explain what it is, because it was being used. I recall a presentation from Dan Satterberg where it was used, I believe, in a murder case.
This is actually a fairly new program that is part of an evolution of an older program called the CEDAR program. Mm-hmm. So this was just launched in November of last year. But there are multiple diversion programs that the King County Prosecutor's Office has, and this is one. But again, it's new, so I'm not sure it's the exact same one. And this definitely does not apply to anyone involved in a murder. Mm-hmm. In that case. But some of the crimes that it does involve that Dunn is concerned about.
Some of the charges I want them to remove are things, serious things like felony harassment, assault in the second degree, assault in the third degree, residential burglary, unlawful possession of a firearm, among other very serious charges that aren't appropriate for diversion.
So, and in answer to your last question, sorry, Dave, it's a community response. This is how they describe it. A community response to harm that focuses on healing and restorative justice rather than punishment. Several years ago, I did the juvenile justice series where I went, they had the, it's various neighborhoods have these community courts where one that I went and visited with was the East African, where you had Somali communities. So if a kid mm-hmm. gets in trouble for stealing, or in some cases even having a gun in their possession, not using it or threatening anybody with it, but having a weapon for some reason, they instead divert that case and they go through kind of like a community system within their own community, where the kind of the elders will come up with whatever the punishment is, and there's some oversight, this is somewhat similar to that, if that makes sense. So Dunn says he acknowledged that he originally actually voted for this program.
It was kind of buried inside the biennial $13 billion biennial budget, and then it wasn't revealed what they were planning to do until they met with South County mayors a month ago. Diversion, which essentially allows lesser offenses to be handled outside of court for juveniles and in some cases adults. By and large, diversion is a good program because you're taking, you know, things like petty theft and drug related charges and putting them through a diversion program. If you do it just right, sometimes if it's a first offense, it won't go on your record. I support diversion programs.
But he says this particular one, in his opinion, goes way too far.
That's not right. It's not good for this community. You know, you have to look around and see what's happening with crime. We are at the top of a 50-year crime wave right now. We had, in 2020, the highest murders in Washington state history. We've had the highest number of shootings ever just last year. It is a serious problem. And so we can't just begin to do what we've done in the recent past, which is, you know, go light on crime, not hold people accountable for serious, dangerous offenses. We need to have judges look at these cases. We need to have judges sentence these various perpetrators for these more serious crimes.
And he says in some cases like this, this is going to be a deterrent situation where if you have a legitimate punishment, like kind of old school punishment we're used to, that's going to be what leads to less recidivism. But the prosecutor's office and those in charge of the diversion program, they disagree. Jimmy Hung is the head of the juvenile justice programs that are over at the King County Prosecutor's Office. And as I said, this was the evolution of a different program that was around for a long time called CEDAR. Now, the CEDAR program was a diversion program after the charge was filed. So it would be on the kid's record. They would touch the criminal justice system. The difference here is that this is a pre-filing diversion program to try to keep the kid from ever touching that system. And Hung says, as far as the crimes that are eligible, there are some that are like Dunn is describing.
You know, robbery is one of the charges that is technically eligible for RCP, but only under very, very certain circumstances, right? So one, you can't have a weapon, and two, you can't cause any sort of bodily harm or injury, right? And so people are still going to look at the charge and be like, wait a minute, you're diverting robberies. And so let me give you an example of the type of robbery we're talking about. So you have a student walking home from school, and then another student walks up to him and says, hey, give me your backpack, and pushes him to the ground. That's a robbery.
And that is some of the robbery cases that they will divert in this. Here's another real life example that I really want to get through for this story.
I personally review every school shooting threat or every gun case that's brought to school. And one of the cases involved this 14-year-old girl who, there was like this whole TikTok thing in social media encouraging kids to bring guns to school. And she brought a gun to school and showed it to other kids and was immediately reported on. And like, I watched the body worn camera, and this girl was a mess. I mean, she literally, when was told that she was being arrested, collapsed to the floor and started sobbing uncontrollably because she had known that she had totally messed up and couldn't believe that this was all going on. And that's not to say like she shouldn't have been held accountable in some way. And she was. She was expelled. And she was arrested.
So that leaves this position.
Like, are we saying like now we got to take this kid who is like clearly, you know, traumatized and like emotionally upset by this and it's just a child, like let's saddle her with a felony criminal conviction as well?
And he says it's an opportunity.
Can we as grown-ups figure out, you know, what was going on? Where did she get the gun? Can we at least make sure that whoever the owner of that gun is secures it next time so this child doesn't end up bringing it to school? And then let's figure out, like, can we teach her more about gun safety, the rest of the school about gun safety?
So that's how he sees it. It does, though, apply if a kid has a gun like that in that situation or blows up a watermelon on school campus with fireworks. That was another case. So differences of opinion here. And I personally can see kind of both sides.
I'd be curious to hear more about this idea of referring these cases to community organizations. Mm-hmm. There are other cultures which have different ways of settling crimes, usually handled through some kind of a kinship network, which
right. That's know, what this is. That's what that East African community court was.
Well, the
was
only problem
like,
with
it takes
that
a
is
village.
Okay, I know that, but there's a downside to those systems, wherein sometimes there's revenge taken against relatives who were not involved. So I'm just wondering how far they want this to go.
Well, and I can certainly look in. I didn't. Yeah. That wasn't my experience in the one story I did on it, but definitely worth looking into.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.